Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Practitioners of meditation and mindfulness have long professed the positive impacts, reduction in stress, improvements in memory, and an overall enhancement of well-being. Quantifying changes and understanding how or why those changes occur is the subject of ongoing research. Joining us to talk about the latest research into meditation and mindfulness and how we can benefit is Dan Goldman. He's a psychologist and author of Emotional Intelligence. His forthcoming book is titled Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body, which he co-authored with Dr. Richard Davison. Welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here, Mindy.
Also with us is Fiona Jensen, founder and executive director of Calmer Choice, a community-based organization partnering with local schools to teach children skills to increase focus and reduce stress. Welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Mindy. Happy to be here.
So, Dan, before we start discussing your new book, Altered Traits, let's go back to your earlier book, Emotional Intelligence, which was published in the 1990s. This book started the conversation about social and emotional learning. So what is emotional intelligence?
It basically means being intelligent about emotion, and there are four parts. One is self-awareness, knowing what you're feeling, how it's impacting you, self-management, using that self-awareness to manage your disturbing emotions so they don't throw you off course, and promoting, you know, positive feelings and motivations, and continuing to focus on your goals despite distractions. The third part is empathy, knowing how other people are feeling, and then putting that all together in your relationships.
Mm. Fiona, tell us more about Calmer Choice and how it fits into the frameworks of social and emotional learning.
So Calmer Choice is a school-based program that brings mindfulness and social-emotional learning programs into the schools. And actually, a lot of what Dan just spoke of is what we actually teach the children.
Exactly.
So it's a lot of it is around self-regulation, recognizing emotions, calming yourself down when you're upset. But in order to do that, you need to recognize that you're upset. Mm-hmm. And so what we've done, really because of Dan, I mean, it was that book that really was the launching pad for a lot of people to look at that part of a child's learning. And we've picked up on what he created and then added a mindful awareness component to that. Mm-hmm. Because I think some of that is you need to recognize when you're, that self-awareness is really the mindful awareness piece.
Let me just make the link. The key here is self-awareness, which is the foundation of emotional intelligence. In the book Emotional Intelligence, I was really arguing for what Fiona is doing, mm-hmm. which is bringing this to kids, making it part of the standard curriculum, because it's just as important the kids manage their emotional lives and their social lives for their future, for, mm-hmm. as parents, as spouses, as workers, whatever it may be, as it is their academics. And we've been focused solely on academics. And recently, I had written a book called The Triple Focus. It's available for More Than Sound online. I'm mm-hmm. sure you'll have it on your mm-hmm. website. But that says that the future of social-emotional learning, which is now very widespread, is exactly what Fiona's doing, helping kids focus, helping kids manage their emotions, use attention training right. as a next step.
Well, I'm just thinking when kids are upset about something, you can see the frustration, and being able yeah. to help them understand what that is and what to do with that is so key. I mean, when you think about it. So meditation and mindfulness are pretty broad terms. So what's important for us to understand about the different levels and paths of the practice?
Well, in the book Altered Traits, we make it very clear that there are many levels of meditation. The first is like the hardcore practitioner, like monks in Asia, you know, has little to do with what's going on over here. The second are kind of watered down versions of that are still highly effective, like insight meditation. The third is packaged kinds of meditation that are not in any religious framework. This is very important. Mm-hmm. They're removed from that context and tested very rigorously. In fact, the first person to urge this was the Dalai Lama mm-hmm. with a group of scientists. And now there's an explosion of research that takes all of these practices outside their belief system, brings them to the lab, tests them rigorously, and shows that there are many, many benefits. And in the book, mm-hmm. Altered Traits, we review all those benefits. And the final level which is the most general, is to look at the benefits, see what can we take from that, like the fact that you can train attention. This is big news. Mm-hmm. You can help kids get better at it. Attention is the key to managing their upsets. Mm-hmm. So if you give them both those tools, you're going to set them on a course for life. So that's the fourth level, is making it widely available without any of the, you know, religious stuff. Mm-hmm. Just look at what cognitive science says about it, what the neuroscience says about it.
Fiona, Common Choice has been working with researchers from Yale. Tell us more about what they've been studying and some of the results.
So interestingly, the research, so we've been working with sixth graders in a bunch of different schools and looking at, some of the schools are getting the program, some of them are not. And they're really interested in anxiety and also self-regulation. So they're looking at those two things. And what they found is that we did a study a year or two ago that hopefully will be published in the next 6 months, but where the children who at the beginning had a high level of stress in both schools, and then after our program it dropped significantly and then stayed dropped for the rest of the year. So we studied them three times during the year versus the children who got nothing. They had a music program. Their anxiety was at the same high level, because there's a high level of anxiety with children, but it just increased throughout the year. Mm. And there was no change in that group at all. Mm-hmm. And then we repeated it again and found very similar findings the following year. Yeah.
So have you modified the Common Choice curriculum based on some of these findings?
So what's interesting is we constantly are improving our program. I mean, our program lives in the cloud. Like, we've got various versions, and every year we've been doing research with universities since 2012, and every year we look at the feedback and we change our program accordingly. We also we ask the children twice mm-hmm. during the program what they liked, what they didn't like, because it's also really important to look at adverse effects. Right. That's equally as important as the positive impact, and that was, you know, something that we're really not focused on, but we want to make sure that if there's a problem that we know about it.
What would adverse effects be?
You know, like, there's been, imagine you're a child and you have issues with asthma, and we're asking you to pay attention to your breath. Mm. That will actually increase anxiety in some children. So mm-hmm. until we got that feedback, we were like, oh my God, of course, like that is something to pay attention to. You don't have to use your breath as an anchor for focus. Mm-hmm. You can use something else. And then, you know, for some children that are you know, we do have some kids on the Cape, actually around the country, that are dealing with a lot of trauma. Mm-hmm. And our program may not be
the right one for them.
And so we're very connected with the social workers and the guidance counselors in the school, and because they know their children. Mm-hmm. And some of those kids might be pulled out. Mm-hmm. But it's our program has always been an opt-in, opt-out program. But we really rely heavily on what the teachers and the social workers know about the kids.
I'd like to say that these kinds of problems are pretty rare, actually.
Most
kids really love the program.
Yeah,
the reason they love the program is that it's about the melodramas of their lives.
Right.
You know, they didn't invite me to that party, and I've been obsessing about it. They won't let me play, but, you know, the things that really upset kids. And this helps kids manage their feelings.
Yeah.
And get along better with other kids. And there's the studies that you've done are part of a growing mountain of research. There was one, what's called a meta-analysis. They put together the results from hundreds of studies, actually 250,000 kids total. Some who got the program, some who did not. And they found that on average, problems went down by 10%, like anxiety or cutting class, whatever. Liking school, pro-social behaviors up 10%, and academic achievement up 11%.
Mm,
And it's the bigger gains are in the schools that need it the most.
Right.
So I'm very happy to see that you're doing rigorous research.
Right.
I think it's very important.
Yeah, sure. Dan, when you and Richard decided to write your forthcoming book, what were some of the questions about meditation and mindfulness that you were hoping to answer?
Well, one of the things we wanted to speak to was the fact that there's a kind of a bandwagon, both a little bit in education, but really in the business world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of people who aren't that well qualified who are selling mindfulness programs to businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And they're looking at the research, some of it not so good, and basically using it as hype to sell the program. And we wanted to have a very rigorous look at what's true and what's not. So there's more than 6,000 peer review articles on meditation now. When Davidson and I started at Harvard, there were zero.
Mm.
So it's been a huge increase. And what we did was He actually used his scientists at the University of Wisconsin. They winnowed all of that down to about 60 out of 6,000 studies that are very, very strong. They're in the top journals. Those are the ones we focus on.
Yeah. In the book, you write, "We live in a world our minds build rather than actually perceiving the endless details of what is happening." Give us an example of this, how it can help explain what's going on in our brains during mindfulness.
So in mindfulness, you have an intentional stance, which is I'm going to simply witness what's going on. It might be with your breath, breathing in, breathing out. Everything else is a distraction. Our usual state of mind is the opposite. We're going to go with the distractions. And you know, this is another point why I'm so happy you're doing this in schools, because kids today don't even know a time that you couldn't have a screen, an electronic screen, to distract you from what's going on right here in your family or with the other kids. And they're under more pressure from very seductive distractions than any generation in human history. And I feel personally that the only weapon they have is their attention. And we need to help them make their attention stronger. And that's exactly what you're doing, is attention training. Yeah. Attention is a mental muscle. The more you flex it, the stronger it gets.
Many of us would assume that our brains are more active when handling a task or problem and less active when we're doing something mundane or rote. But researchers have found that regardless of what we're doing, even nothing at all, our brains are always active and consuming a constant amount of metabolic energy. So what is our brain doing when we think it's doing nothing?
Well, we all know what it does. It wanders. And where it tends to wander is to our relationships. And where it tends to obsess is the trouble in our relationships. There's research at Harvard. There was a paper they published in Science called "A Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind." Mm. And it's simply because we tend to obsess about what's upsetting us in our relationships. I mean, the mind wanders 50% of the time. It could be to something neutral, but that's not where it prefers to go.
You're listening to The Point. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the latest research into meditation and mindfulness and how we can benefit with Dan Goleman. He's a psychologist and author of Emotional Intelligence. His forthcoming book is Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body, which he co-authored with Dr. Richard Davison and Fiona Jensen, founder and executive director of Calmer Choice, a community-based organization partnering with local schools to teach children skills to increase focus and reduce stress. Fiona, the brain research is really fascinating. So are there opportunities in the Calmer Choice program to share some of that with students? Do you get to talk to students and parents about what's going on?
Yeah, actually a big part of our program is teaching kids, even as young as four, about their amygdala and their prefrontal cortex and the hippocampus. And
can they say that?
They can. It's actually kind of amazing. We've got parents of like preschoolers who are like, they're saying, what's the amygdala? Like, parents don't even know about it. But we talk about the wise owl, which is your prefrontal cortex, and the guard dog, which is your amygdala, and what happens when, you know, somebody steals a toy and you find yourself getting all triggered. And it's kind of amazing because that's the first step around emotional regulation, is to know that you've been triggered. But we have stories. There was a little boy, a mom who called me, who shared this story of she had a second grader who like was losing it because she wanted him to put on his snowsuit. And they were getting into this big fight, and he just got up, walked into his room. He came out a few minutes later and he put on his snowsuit. And she said, you know, Isaiah, what just happened? And he said, well, my amygdala was firing off and I had no access to my prefrontal cortex. So I had to go do my five-finger breathing and now I'm fine. And she looked at him and she actually wrote me a letter because she was so shocked. She's a guidance counselor in one of the schools in Barnstable.
So
but it's that empowerment. Like, what would it look like if we all knew that when somebody cut us off in traffic and these words come out of our mouth, which we never say, we could go, because you lose it. And there's a reason. So we very much tie the brain science into all of our lessons.
Dan, what are some of the benefits of mindfulness and meditation that you can quantify right off the bat as someone begins the practice?
Sure. Right from the beginning, actually, the amygdala quiets. And the ability to say, that's my guard dog, and I need my, what do you
wise
call
owl.
My wise owl, does something in the brain. Mm-hmm. This is research from UCLA. The minute you can distance yourself and say, it's my amygdala, you've activated a different part of the prefrontal cortex, which actually has inhibitory neurons. inhibitory circuits for amygdala activity. So that is the essence of mindfulness, is noticing what's going on, not getting caught up in it, but stepping back from it. Mm. And that gives you a power you never had before. It's wonderful you're doing it with four-year-olds. I'm delighted to hear that.
It's very sweet.
Give us an idea. So if people are going, how do you do this? So give us an idea. Maybe take us through an exercise to give listeners an idea of how mindfulness practice works.
Here's the basic move. Let's say you're going to be mindful of your breath. So you have a contract with yourself that I'm just going to watch my breath. When my mind wanders, I'm going to bring it back and start with the next breath. It's that simple. It's not easy, but it's simple. Mm-hmm. It's not easy because our minds are used to wandering.
Right.
So you start with your breath, breathing in, breathing out, and then what am I going to have for lunch, or that thing she said to me, whatever the distraction is. And you go off on the train, and then, you notice I'm distracted. That's the moment of mindfulness.
Right.
And then you bring your mind back to the breath. That is what strengthens the circuitry for attention. Mm. That very simple act. You decide I'm going to focus here. Your mind wanders. You notice it wanders. You bring it back. That is the equivalent for mental fitness of going to a gym and lifting weights. Every rep makes the muscle stronger. Mm.
So what is compassion meditation? How does it differ from more traditional meditation?
So in mindfulness of the breath, you're just watching something that comes and goes by itself. In loving-kindness meditation, you generate positive feelings toward yourself, toward people you love, toward people you know, an ever-widening circle. And it turns out there are research shows that the brain is very ready to strengthen the circuitry for love. Mm-hmm. Who knew? Mm-hmm. So the effects from those kindness meditations show up very early and are very strong. We were surprised to find that.
Hmm. Fiona, are there aspects to the compassion meditation practice that you've incorporated into Calmer Choice?
We have, though. It's kind of interesting. I was sharing with Dan earlier that we are really careful to make it pretty concrete. So a lot of what we do around, we talk about kindness and generosity a lot in our lessons, but it's much more sort of like sending, it's almost like sending a greeting card to yourself or to other people. So it is a secular program, and that's one of the things that we've needed to be really careful about because we're in public schools. But we weave kindness and love into pretty much everything that we teach the children.
Yeah. When you talk with students, teachers, and school staff, what are some of the prevalent issues for students? Anxiety, anger?
Anxiety is probably the highest thing that we find. And the one that is most kind of shocking to parents and to teachers is the difference in the level of anxiety now than when it was 30 years ago. And I think a lot of that has to do with what Dan was talking about screen time and how fast our life is moving. And I think it's created anxious parents, which in turn then creates anxiety in children. On the Cape, of course, we've got this big issue with substance abuse and the opioid issue. And, for me, my feeling, I always tell the story of imagine, the onset for anxiety disorder in this country is between 4 and 6, and depression is between 11 and 13. And so imagine being a 13-year-old girl and you're in the woods in Woods Hole and somebody hands you a joint or a beer and your anxiety goes away, and nobody up until that point has really taught you how to manage that.
So you self-medicate with a drug.
Exactly.
But if you give kids a better alternative, then they don't need it.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. And since you're mentioning the opioid addiction and overdose, of course, is a huge problem here and nationwide. Yeah. What are your thoughts on the role of mindfulness in prevention, but also in treatment? You're talking, this could be, your 13-year-olds, you have a different way of treating your anxiety. But what about somebody who's already using? Could this be used as a treatment?
Absolutely. I mean, I don't know, Dan, if you have experience with any of the...
Well, it is being used, but it's not just mindfulness alone. It's mindfulness plus cognitive therapy is the most powerful modality for treating a range of disorders, depression, anxiety, which often underlie the substance abuse.
Yeah, I was going to say the mindfulness would be treating more the anxiety.
So it goes like this. Mindfulness helps with anxiety generally, reduces it. Mindfulness-based cognitive therapy combines this ability to watch your mind with steps in what to do. Mm. What should I do when I have these kinds of thoughts? You can counter those thoughts. That's the cognitive therapy part.
Gotcha.
So the two together turn out to be very powerful.
Dan, you write that for early practitioners, the benefits are fragile and the practice needs to be sustained if the benefits are to be sustained. So again, it's like when you were talking about exercise.
Exactly.
Same kind of thing. Like what you would do with your physical body, you want to do that with the mindfulness.
Yeah, exactly. So just as with exercise, with meditation, it's very easy to say, well, this is a really busy day. I don't have time. That's when you lose the effects. Mm-hmm. In order to sustain the effects, just as with exercise, as you say, you have to keep doing it every day. And then the effects turn out to get stronger and stronger. It's even better if you go away for an intensive retreat for a period. You have faster gains. But same is true if you worked out intensively.
I was going to say, you can see where you wouldn't want to say, I don't want to do that today. You, as my grandmother says, you make times for things that are important to you. But if it's making you feel good and you feel that, same thing with the exercise. You know, do you really want to go to the gym? No, but you feel good after you do that.
So, you know, what's interesting is we did research with children. You know, we did it initially, you know, at the beginning and the end of the program. And then we got the critics saying, well, yeah, like, are they still using it? And what we found was, so then we researched children who had it. And then a year later, we worked with those kids again to see. And what we found is that there was an actual increase in the usage a year later in certain things, you know, for anxiety and sleeping at night. Because it's just like you said, you know, if this is something that I can do, this five-finger breathing, which we teach the kids, and it helps me, but it helps me in real life. It's not just in school. Kids are actually using it more, which was for us, you know, research is funny. You don't actually know you're going to get what you want. But we were really shockingly and happy to hear that there was an increase in a lot of what we taught the kids because they like it, the brain likes it, and it makes an impact.
Makes them feel good.
Right.
Yeah. All right. So, Dan, another sports analogy you mentioned in the book is the value of coaching to improve and to make the most of your time in practice. Explain why coaching is important in mindfulness.
You know, if you go to the gym, let me start there, and you say, well, I'm going to go through these Nautilus machines. It's not the same as having a coach who says, well, you know, you need help with this muscle and that muscle. It's the same. It's true in any area of expertise. You learn better and faster and more efficiently if you have the eyes of an experienced coach to give you feedback. Right. It's that simple.
Yeah, because sometimes you're not using the machine correctly. And how would you know that, right?
Exactly.
How would you know that?
Only know that if the coach said.
So, Dan, you also write that markers for inflammation lessen after practice. This is important.
Well, you know, there is a huge range of medical disorders which are boosted by high levels of inflammation of the body. Everything from asthma and heart disease to, you know, you name it. Mm-hmm. So this is kind of a universal help that regular meditation over time seems to reduce the levels of inflammation in the body. It does. That's just one of many benefits we find that are cumulative from meditation.
Yeah. You're listening to The Point. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the latest research into meditation and mindfulness and how we can benefit. With us this morning, Dan Goleman, who is a psychologist and author of Emotional Intelligence. His forthcoming book is titled Altered Traits: Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body, which he co-authored with Dr. Richard Davidson. Also with us is Fiona Jensen, a founder and executive director of Calmer Choice, a community-based organization partnering with local schools to teach children skills to increase focus and reduce stress. Another surprise finding is that more hours in practice of mindfulness meditation correlates with increased immunity. Now, how is that measured, and what are some of the theories as to why?
Well, the immune measures are very hard medical measures. They're levels of what are called antibody titers. It's the ability of the immune system to mobilize cells to fight a particular disease. But the rough correlation of time, hours of lifetime meditation. Think about that. So if you do a half hour every morning for a month, that's 15 hours. We're talking about people who have done 2,000 hours, 8,000 hours, 30,000 hours, lifetime meditation. In other words, who have made it a regular habit.
Yeah. Are there any studies following the long-term practitioners of meditation and mindfulness to see if they have lower rates of type 2 diabetes, heart disease, or obesity?
You know, these studies, there are a lot of studies now in the pipeline, but there's no study yet that shows that meditation in itself will cure a disease. I don't think we're going to find that. I think it will up your odds of not getting the disease or lessening it, certainly living better with a chronic disease. In fact, here on the Cape, there's a man, John Kabat-Zinn, an old friend, mm-hmm. who's developed mindfulness-based stress reduction, MBSR, which is used around the world now in hospitals and clinics because it helps people who have chronic pain, for example, mm-hmm. have a better day. With even though they can't cure the pain.
Right. I was going to say, even just being able to lower the stress, I mean, you know, we know what stress does to our yes. bodies. And so just being able to lower that, you
exactly.
know, in itself is...
But there's something else that goes on, which is that mindfulness allows you to change your relationship to the experience yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. that it's you don't have that psychological component.
Right.
Oh, my gosh, my pain.
Yeah.
It's like there's that sensation again.
Finding the time to start the practice of mindfulness can be difficult. We talked a little about how easy it can be, but what are some thoughts on how to get started? You know, all these busy people running around, they're like, yeah, that sounds great, but how do I get started?
Well, it helps to have a teacher if you can find one. However, there are now a number of apps that are actually pretty good. A friend of mine, Dan Harris, did one called 10% Happier.
Oh, great book.
Which uses, but he did an app, mm-hmm. and he uses one of the best mindfulness teachers in the country, Joseph Goldstein, mm-hmm. as the instructor.
Oh.
And I know a 19-year-old friend who started, and he said, you know, I tried it, and I liked it so much, I do it every morning. Because for one thing, Harris is very funny.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other is Goldstein is very good. So, you know, that's just one of many, many.
All right. Research has suggested that doing mental exercises while doing physical exercise, for example, taking a walk while having a conversation, improves memory and cognition. Could there be benefit to combining mindfulness with exercise? Can you do that?
Yes, you can. And in fact, there's one study so far that suggests that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's funny. My husband's running 100 miles from like Woods Hole to Provincetown to raise money. And he used to listen to an iPod. And then he, you know, started doing mindfulness. He actually is one of our teachers. But he had a whole conversation with John Kabat-Zinn about how it was a completely different experience for him to be running mindfully and paying attention to his feet on the ground and to the sensation of pain, which obviously happens after 50 miles of running. And
So. Fiona, I wanted to mention something we talked about before we began recording this program, and that is how far I mean, remember when we first started talking about this? And this, so for folks who don't know the history, tell them how Calmer Choice came to be. This was your daughter and her friends.
Right. So it all sort of came to me, and I think it was like 2009 when Lily was a junior at Barnesville High School, and a young man had just been murdered. And I had 2 years earlier taken John's MBSR class, not taught by John, but by another gentleman on the Cape, Adam Liss. And I had taken it, and it had really impacted my life. And 2 years later, I'm standing in my kitchen, and there's my daughter who had just lost this friend. And there was a series of children in there, and I knew one of them was addicted to OxyContin and another one who was having anxiety every morning before school. And, you know, I went around the room, and I thought, these kids are just so highly stressed. And I thought, you know, what if I could just bring one program into that high school? Because then, strangely, not 2 weeks later, there was a suicide, and 2 weeks after that, there was another suicide. So it was sort of by the time school started, the whole community was kind of a mess. And so what started as one program has grown into an organization now that's where we've worked with over 15,000 children in 23 schools. And I went from being a full-time occupational therapist, you know, at the visiting nurses, to now being the full-time executive director of Calmer Choice. It's not what I thought I'd be doing with my life. It's not what I went to school for, but it is, I feel like we are at the right place at the right time. And now, as I like to say, that the crisis around the opiate epidemic that was happening in my kitchen back in 2009 is like front page news now.
Right.
So it's sort of you know, and just to say all of those children that were in my kitchen are actually okay today. Interestingly, they're all like sustaining members of Commerce Choice. They give like $2 a month. They're like, which is great, you know, $5 a month.
Yeah. And talk about in the beginning when you went into the school and you said, hey, I've got this idea for a program. Not everybody was on board.
No. And I think the only reason we really got in was because they were in crisis. And I think that the assistant principal just looked like I had fallen from the sky. Like, of course you can come in. But we, you know, it wasn't a positive reception everywhere because it was a little bit outside the box and we had no data, you know, like we had a lot of stories that
anecdotal
were really
stuff,
amazing, but we didn't have data and I didn't know how to do that. And then, you know, Tufts stepped in and then Yale stepped in and we went from that one district that didn't want us back until we had data into other districts where, you know, you can't collect data unless you're teaching the program.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the amazing things about Commerce Choice is the tenacity that of us just moving forward. Like we had no idea that we would be where we are today.
Right. And impacting so many kids.
It's kind of amazing.
You mentioned earlier a four-year-old and Dan, you said, oh, I'm glad you're teaching the four-year-olds. How young can you start this?
Well, I know, you know, Richie Davidson, who wrote the book, he's got a preschool study. So those are four-year-olds.
Yeah, he's working with preschoolers, I guess 3 and 4.
Yeah.
But, you know, you don't start it the same way you would for a 10-year-old or a 20-year-old. Mm-hmm. You have to do it in an age-appropriate way.
Right, right. And how would you do that with preschool? I mean, you don't know.
One of the things he does is what Fiona was alluding to. He calls it the kindness course.
Mm-hmm.
And what you do is promote kindness. And kids talk about kindness. They have a sticker garden. And if someone does something kind for you, you can tell the teacher. And she'll give that child who was kind a sticker. 3 and 4-year-olds think that's the biggest thing in the world.
You know?
So, and what they find, this is so interesting. Of course, they do research. As kids get into school age, they become more self-centered and more selfish.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't happen with these kids who went through the kindness program.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting.
Yeah.
We're bombarded by distractions constantly, especially in the age of smartphones. Is there evidence that in this new age of technology that we're in danger of raising a generation that has a markedly reduced attention span? You sort of alluded this, Dan. And is mindfulness the potential antidote to that?
Well, it's not that the attention span is getting shorter, because if you watch a kid who's fixated on a screen, they have long attention spans for that. What's happening is that the amount, density, and intensity of distractions is increasing. So, you know, there's this fiction of multitasking, for example.
Right.
The brain doesn't do two things in parallel. It switches very rapidly. And if you are very concentrated on one thing, your math homework or something you're doing for work, and then you switch, you get, I've got to look at the text, I've got to check Facebook, whatever it is. When you go back to that first thing, your concentration is much diminished, unless you do mindfulness.
Hmm.
Actually, that nullifies the effect.
Hmm.
So that's one way. There's other effects that are very important for kids. It enhances attention skills. Attention is the basis of learning.
Hmm.
So there was a study at UC Santa Barbara that found the kids who did mindfulness, these are college students, not only had better attention, their scores on the graduate school entrance exam were 30% higher.
Wow.
So it helps learning. And I think this is something that should be emphasized, particularly in schools.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you're in 23 schools, Fiona, and I'm sure there might be people going, hey, how do I get that into my school? How do they get it into their school?
So they can email us at commercechoice.org. A lot of it is speaking to the leadership in the school and letting them know that we are here and that they're interested. We're in most of the districts on the Cape. Mm-hmm. We're really fully involved in probably 4 out of the 10, and it's growing, you know. So I think, you know, a lot of parents will email me and say, how can I get this program in? Part of it is right now we're sort of at capacity until we can grow our staff. So we're really looking at training schools to be able to provide this programming for themselves. It's better from a sustainability standpoint. It's a good thing. And the other thing is we're starting to do community-based programming. We're working with about 20% of the children on Cape Cod. So for the rest, which is a large percentage, we're working at getting to them. But in the meantime, we're doing a lot more after-school programs.
Right. Dan Goleman is the author of, with Dr. Richard Davidson, of the forthcoming book, Altered Traits, Science Reveals How Meditation Changes Your Mind, Brain, and Body. And that's coming out in September?
Yeah, you can pre-order.
Don't rush out and get it yet. It's not available yet.
You can pre-order it online, and there's an audio. You can get it more than sound.
Okay. And you'll be giving a talk Thursday, August 3rd at 7 p.m. at the Tilden Arts Center at Cape Cod Community College. We'll have a link with more information about his talk and Calmer Choice at our website, capeandislands.org. Fiona Jensen and Dan Goleman, thanks so much for coming in. And Fiona, thanks for being tenacity. They're getting that tenacity in there.
Thank you,
Mindy. Thanks for having us, Mindy.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.